Yeah, first of all, I'd like to thank KHP for supporting this workshop and the organizers for making this to happen. So I'm going to talk about a recent paper that I posted a few weeks ago. So as you know that strongly coupled quantum field theories, they're hard to solve in general, but fortunately there are theories that have recoupling description in terms of dual variables. And this happens when ordinary particles remain strongly coupled and very incoherent, yet they somehow are organized into some collective excitations that have long lifetime. If that happens, then we should, in principle, be able to find a new variable that captures this long-lived collective excitation, and then one can access the strong coupling dynamics of the original particle using this new variable. Then this non-trivial dynamical information about this original particle is encoded in this change of variable. And here I'm going to talk about two such examples. One is fractionalization. This is an example where the new variables, the weakly coupled variables, carry a new quantum number. We know that low energy degrees freedom may carry a composite, maybe a composite object, in which case the quantum number is given by sum of some quantum numbers of microscopic particle. But what's surprising in fractionalization is that new variables carry actually fractional quantum number compared to the microscopic particles. And then second example is the holography. And the bottom line is that there is some common theme behind these two seemingly very different phenomena. And I will try to uncover some common aspect of these two phenomena. So for fractionalization, I will introduce some pedagogical microscopic model which shows fractionalization, and then we'll discuss that fractionalization can be understood in terms of immersion gauge theory. And then when fractionalization happens, then there is some non-trivial what we call quantum order that makes fractionalized phase qualitatively distinct from more conventional phases of matter. And for holography, we'll start with some matrix model in general dimension with gauge symmetry. And then I will construct a holographic dual for this matrix model from a first principle construction, and we'll show that the dual theory is actually a field theory of closed string in one higher dimension space. And this string variables is coupled with a two-form gauge field. And in this regard, I will argue that holography can be viewed as emergent two-form gauge theory in one higher dimension space. And when field theory admit holographic description, there is a distinct quantum order associated with this emergent two-form gauge field, in the same sense that usually spin liquid phase in condensed matter system possess some non-trivial quantum order associated with emergent gauge field. So this is the bottom line of this talk. Okay, so original idea of fractionalization is by Anderson, but here I'm considering a very simple pedagogical model just to make the point. So here I have some four-dimensional lattice. Ij are side indices for the four-dimensional lattice. We can view this as a three space and one time. And at each side, I have a bunch of boson fields. And this theta AB is the phase of the boson field. And this boson carries one flavor A and one anti-flavor B, which run from 1 to n. And suppose AB boson and BA bosons are antiparticle to each other. So formally, it means this theta is anti-symmetric in the flavor space. The first term describes the user kinetic energy term, where boson can hop from site I to site j, and then while preserving the flavor. And then second term is a cubic interaction, where two boson, say with flavor AB and flavor BC, collide and become a new boson with flavor AC. So in this cubic interaction, the flavor is conserved. So because of this flavor conservation, there's some global symmetry, U1 to the N minus 1. It's not U1 to the N because this boson does not carry any net flavor. So all boson is made of one flavor and one anti-flavor. Okay, so suppose I put this model into computer and solve the phase diagram. And here's the phase diagram that one would get. So when K3, when the cubic interaction is weak, then as a function of this hopping strength, there are two phases. When the hopping strength is weak, then all excitations are gapped, and there's no symmetry breaking. This is the usual disordered phase. When this hopping strength is large, then the boson has large phase thickness, so system breaks the global symmetry spontaneously. And then there are Goldstone modes, exactly the same number expected from the global symmetry. But as the interaction strength is increased, there is a interesting third phase. And in this third phase, there is no spontaneous symmetry breaking. Nonetheless, I find two gapless modes in this phase. And this gapless mode is very peculiar in the sense that it's not Goldstone mode, because symmetry is not broken. And this is not by any fine tuning. You don't need to fine tune. And this gapless mode exists within whole parameter space, finite parameter space. So this is not a Goldstone mode. This is not by fine tuning. And what makes this gapless mode stable against acquiring mass from quantum correction? So to explain this, and then of course another question is, how would we distinguish this phase one and phase three? Because these two phases have same symmetry, but they are in different universality class, because one is fully gapped, the other has a robust gapless mode. So there must be a way to characterize these different phases of matter, and there must be a reason that explains this gapless mode in this phase three. And then the notion of what is called quantum order has been introduced. And this is not symmetry breaking order. This is order in the pattern of long range entanglement in the many body wave function. And this provides an explanation for why there exists gapless mode whose robustness is not from any microscopic symmetry. And we can use this order in the pattern entanglement to classify different phases of matter. So we don't have a complete picture what this quantum order means, but we at least know there is something very special in those phases that they support this kind of a gapless mode. In particular, if two phases have different quantum order, and even though they have same symmetry, they are in different universal classes. So physically, what happens is the following. In partition function, in principle, we have to sum over all possible configurations with different topology. So we can associate some topology for field configuration. And microscopically, there is no symmetry reason why we have to consider only one topological sector. But in some parameter region, the system may dynamically choose one particular topological sector. Then, even though symmetry is same, there is some kind of topological order or topological selection. And if this happens, then we have sometimes ground state degeneracy or robust gapless mode. Okay, so, and then one nice way of understanding this new phase with the gapless mode is actually using gauge theory description. So suppose we consider the strong coupling limit where K3 is very large. We first need to minimize this potential energy before we worry about the kinetic energy. And this potential energy is minimized if this cyclic sum of the phase, theta AB BC CA, equals zero at each site. And this dynamical constraint is satisfied if and only if theta AB is written as some phi A minus phi B. Okay. So this phi A and phi B is usually called slave particle or parton. Okay. They are just some variables that parameterize the low energy manifold on which this potential energy is minimized. Okay. Within that low energy manifold, now we can drop this potential energy. And then we now focus on this kinetic term for ordinary boson. But in terms of this parton, this original kinetic term becomes quartic because theta is made of two phis. And this reaction is quite interesting in the sense that there is no bare kinetic term for this parton phase. There is no quadratic Hopping term. But still, these partons can get delocalized in space-time through mutual Hopping. For example, here, parton A can hop from site J to I when parton B hop from I to J. So they can exchange their position, and then they can explore space and time.
And how do I see that? How do I see that? It seems like they can hop independently. These two terms, just a product, right? Just separate products.
Right. In the flavor space.
Yeah. So why one has to correlate with another?
So this A and B doesn't have to be correlated. So when some parton hops from one side to another side. Mm-hmm. Another parton can hop from I to J. But this A and B can be anything.
Yeah, I'm just confused why that happens from this Lagrangian.
Oh.
Why that should happen at the same time, say from I to J, J to I.
Oh, so it's like original boson AB hop from site I to J. Mm-hmm. Then it's like a flavor A is flowing in one direction. Flavor B is flowing in the other direction. Mm-hmm. Right, that's the reason. So there's always Hopping of this original boson, which carries one flavor and one anti-flavor. So this is basically this term, right? Boson with flavor A and anti-flavor B, mm-hmm. hop from site I to J. Mm-hmm. So flavor A is flowing from I to J, mm-hmm. and anti-flavor B is flowing I to J. It is equivalent to saying that flavor B is flowing from J to I. So that is the distance. And then so these partons can hop only through the help of other partons. They cannot hop just by themselves. And then the extent to which these partons can be delocalized in space and time depends on the dynamics of themselves. Okay. So therefore, it's useful to introduce some collective field that characterize the strength of this mutual Hopping. And mathematically, this can be done by introducing some auxiliary field, some complex field, eta, to decouple this quartic action into quadratic term. So this is just an inverse Gaussian integration. If you integrate over eta field, you restore this original action. Now this term this action contains the quadratic action for the parton phase. But the price we have to pay is that this parton is not free anymore. This eta field contains some phase mode. This is a complex field. In this phase mode, Aij, defined on every link, plays the role of elongated field, couples to this parton field. Okay, so formally, this theory can be viewed as a compact elongated theory coupled with n partons, n slave particles. And then this phase becomes the elongated field. And this is very special gauge theory because there is no kinetic term for this gauge field. In this regard, the gauge coupling is infinite. There is no Maxwell term for the gauge field. Okay. However, as we go to low energy and we integrate out some high energy mode in the theory, we get some low energy effective action. In the low energy effective action, all possible terms consistent with the microscopic symmetry is generated. The microscopic symmetry is the flavor symmetry, and then the gauge symmetry. Therefore, we have some kind of Maxwell's term to be generated at low energy through quantum correction.
So the theory starts with basis in the strong coupling in the gauge theory.
Right. Yeah. So it starts from a...
somehow you need to generate a small coupling constant.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so gauge coupling runs from infinite to some small value.
But usually the opposite.
Depends on matter contents of the theory. And the gauge group. And the dimensionality of the system. Okay, so quantum fluctuation generates some dynamics for the gauge field. And when the number of partons is large, then gauge group is, renormalized gauge coupling is order of 1 over n, because there are n metal fields that screen the gauge field. The gauge coupling becomes weaker as n grows. And another important point is that this gauge field is compact, because this phase 0 and 2 pi is identified. Therefore, there is a topological defect for the gauge field. And this topological defect is nothing but a monopole, which carries the magnetic charge for this U1 gauge field. And because the gauge coupling is order of 1 over n in the larger limit, the mass of the monopole scales as n. Therefore, if n is sufficiently large, then we expect that monopole is heavy, so that in the long distance limit, monopoles are suppressed. Therefore, even though monopoles are not prohibited from microscopic dynamics, so for sufficiently large n, monopoles are suppressed dynamically. And then in the long distance limit, we have this emergent Bianchi identity. And as a result of this, the photons, now the emergent gauge field, become massless in this Coulomb phase. And then in this Coulomb phase, the low energy excitations are the gapless gauge boson, which is nothing but some collective excitations of original boson in this case, and the fractionalized bosons, the parton fields, are now deconfined. And this is called fractionalization because these partons carry only one flavor quantum number, and they arise as the confined excitation in the low energy limit. Okay. And then, although these fractionalized particles and gauge bosons are not gauge invariant objects, in the larger limit, they are weakly coupled, and they become classical. And they are good variables to use to describe this long-lived collective excitations of the system. In this sense, we can view fractionalization as emergence of internal space, where internal space being the phase of this parton field. Okay. Now let us switch to holography. So the strong form of the correspondence is that the d-dimensional quantum gauge theory is exactly dual to d plus one dimensional string theory at the quantum level. And in some parameter limit, one can use some classical approximation in one side to learn about the strong coupling dynamics of the gauge theory. And this is believed to be a general framework for a large class of quantum field theory. And there are a lot of works to give precise meaning to this. And this talk is also geared to that question. And then the question that I would like to address in this talk is the following. Do those state that admit holographic description possess non-trivial quantum orders. In the same sense that the fractionalized phases has non-trivial quantum order. And the claim is, the answer is yes. And the signature for the non-trivial quantum order is the emergent external space and the confined string in the bulk and the existence of an operator whose scaling dimension is protected. Yet this operator has nothing to do with the global symmetry in the boundary field. So in this sense, those field theory that have a hollow FET description form a distinct universalist class that is qualitatively different from more conventional phases of the field theory. Okay, so let's introduce the microscopy model. So I'm considering a matrix model, and this matrix model is defined in d-dimensional Euclidean lattice. And then basic degree of freedom is n by n complex matrices defined on every nearest neighbor link, say ij. And I require that there is a un gauge symmetry, namely the action is invariant under the local un gauge transformation. So the simplest term that I can imagine in my action is this kind of trace u dagger u. It's like a mass term defined on every link. But more generally, I can have some arbitrary function of Wilson loop, where Wilson loop is the trace of path-ordered products of these matrices. And this potential V can be expanded as a power series of the Wilson loop. So for n equal 1, I have one Wilson loop. So it's a single trace operator. And then I have JC. So JC is a loop-dependent coupling constant. And then for n equal 2, I have double trace operator, and I have a coupling constant JC1 and C2. These are loop-dependent sources for the double trace operators, and etc. And I'm interested in the limit where n is large with fixed m and j. So this is the truth coupling limit where the action is manifestly proportional to n squared. And here, j roughly corresponds to the inverse of the truth coupling. So this is the microscopic action. And this action can be viewed as a linear sigma model in some sense. For example, if I choose this kind of potential with some quadratic term and then quartic term and some Plaquette term, then depending on the sign in front of the quadratic term, if the sign combined with this term, if the sign is positive, then the U field has a minimum at U equals 0, and then the fluctuation is gapped. On the other hand, if the sign is negative for the quadratic term, then the minimum for the U field arises at some finite amplitude. And then the amplitude fluctuation is gapped. What remains as gapless mode is the phase mode. In this case, phase mode is the unitary matrix. And then the low-energy theory becomes some UN gauge theory whose coupling constant is determined by this J's and the expectation value for the U field, the amplitude of the U field.
So can I just ask, could you remind me, I mean, the action for a normal lattice gauge theory, how does that compare?
These aren't unitary
matrices,
they're just complex.
Yeah, this is a complex matrix. But if you freeze the amplitude mode, and if you only have the phase mode, then that becomes the usual UN gauge theory. In that sense, this is kind of linear sigma model for the gauge theory. Okay, so how do we construct hollow FX theory starting from this matrix model? Somehow I got the old version. Let me switch into. I have more transparency. Okay. Oh, sorry, this is too. Okay, yeah, so okay, let's do this later. Yeah, sorry about the delay. So the basic idea is the following. So the partition function can be viewed as contraction of d-dimensional array of tensors, where each box represents basically e to the minus s action. And then this quantity depends on the external source, and then the internal degree freedom, which is the U field, right? But the external source is fixed one, but the internal degrees freedoms in the partition function, we integrate them over. That means we contract these tensors. And these tensors form a d-dimensional array because it's a d-dimensional field theory. Okay. So this is the first thing that we realize. And then instead of integrating out this internal,
you have the path integral into little boxes, d-dimensional boxes, and
right, you can think in that way. Right. So you divide your space into little boxes and integrate all degrees of freedom within inside the box, and live with the degrees of freedom on the boundary, and then your partition function is kind of contraction of these little boxes by integrating over the fields defined on these boundaries. Yeah, that's one way of thinking.
That's the U.
Yeah, that's the U. And this box represents this effective action depends on this boundary field within each box. Okay.
So it is like a block speed transformation.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
But in your case, you have a field.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah, this is just a pictorial way, but yeah, I mean, you can divide your system. So actually here, this each line represents the individual U field. So each box is like a point on the lattice in this case. And then each lattice point is connected to each other through this link variable. And these link variables are U fields. And then instead of integrating out this U field in the one shot, we try to integrate them out bit by bit, following the user strategy of a renormalization group. So we divide this U field into high energy modes and low energy modes. And this can be done even when you have only one field. And this can be done even at each link. So the technique is, for example, if I have this kind of integration for the U field with mass n and some quartic and high order term, then I introduce some auxiliary field U tilde, and then from U and U tilde, I change the variable into U low and U high. Then I can always choose this coefficient A and B in such a way that original U field is given by sum of low energy and high energy field, and then the mass term for the low energy field and mass term for the high energy field is given by this quantity. So the mass for the low energy field is slightly larger than the original mass by some infinitesimal parameter. So alpha is some constant that I can choose, and dz is some infinitesimal parameter. The mass for the high energy mode is very large in the small dz limit. So although this auxiliary field U tilde is completely on physical mode, now in the new basis, U low and U high contain some component of the original physical mode. And then the high energy mode carries some small infinitesimal quantum fluctuations of the original field. That's why the mass is very large. And then if you integrate this high energy field out, then you will get some low effective action for the low energy field. That's one way of doing this RG, first introduced by Zhou a long time ago. Okay. Now we can view this high energy field as some kind of dynamical source for the low energy field. From the low energy field's point of view, this is some kind of a source field, right? But this is dynamical because U high energy is a dynamical field. And this can be made more explicit by introducing some auxiliary field and decouples the low energy field and high energy field, like this. So here, phi and phi star are some auxiliary field. So phi is the dynamical source for the low energy field. And phi star can be viewed as a Lagrangian multiplier that imposes the constraint that this low energy field phi is determined by the original source and the high energy mode. So physical meaning of phi is the dynamical source for the low energy field, and phi star is a Lagrangian multiplier. More physically, this phi star plays a role of U low energy from the point of view of the high energy field. So phi star is kind of a VEF, fluctuating vacuum expectation value of the low energy field, and phi is the fluctuating source. So at this stage, phi and phi stars are pure auxiliary field. They don't have any action. But now we integrate out this high energy mode. Then it generates some non-trivial action for this auxiliary field. And now at this stage, we are left with a theory for the low energy field, whose source is fluctuating. The source is a dynamical field. And this fluctuation of the source is controlled by some dynamical action generated out of this high energy mode. Now we can do this thing repeatedly for this low energy field. We can further divide this into low energy and high energy mode, and then at the after integrating out this high energy mode, we introduce a pair of source and then conjugate field at each step of RG. Then in the end, the original partition function, in the partition function, the U field is completely gone. They are integrated out. And what is left with is the dynamical source and its conjugate field at each step of RG. And then the partition function is written as a D plus one dimensional array of matrices, where the new degree of freedom now is the dynamical source and its conjugate field. The new field is gone. So although I explained this in a pictorial way, this can be done in a precise mathematical way. So we start from some field theory, and we integrate out high energy modes in each step of RG, and at each step we introduce fluctuating source and fluctuating depth, and then we build on. So here are some key features. This is an exact change of variable from original U field into this dynamical source and dynamical depth. And in this construction, D-dimensional partition function can be written as D plus one-dimensional partition function for dynamical sources and their conjugate fields. And essentially, this kind of procedure can be applied to any field theory. And if we apply this procedure to the gauged matrix model, then since the sources are defined in the loop space, the degree of freedom in this bulk description is a field of loop, field defined on the in the space of loop. So basically, we have field theory of closed loops in the bulk. So in the end, this is what we get. The partition function of the original gauged matrix model is given by functional integration of this loop field and its conjugate field. So this loop field have two indices. So C is the loop index within each slice, and Z is this length scale corresponding to this RG scale. So in that sense, this is a D plus one dimensional field. And then the action is made of three terms. So there is a bulk action, and then there is a action depends only on the UV boundary field. So Z equals zero is the UV. And then there is an action. So if I stop this RG procedure at certain scale, then generically I have some IR boundary, and then I have an action for the IR boundary field. But if I do this infinitely, and then if I don't have IR boundary, then the last term is absent. But in general, there is a if there's an IR boundary, then there is a higher boundary action. So this UB boundary action plays the role of imposing the boundary condition at the UB. Okay. So if I solve the equation motion for phi 0, then I will get some boundary condition for the phi field. And if I have only a single trace operator in the V, suppose V is like J times phi C star, then solving phi star implies that phi C equals J. So that's the usual Dirichlet boundary condition. If you turn on more, if you turn on multi-trace operator in your boundary action, then in general, the boundary condition become mixed boundary condition. Okay, so that's what this UB boundary action does. And this bulk action is made of four terms. So here the first term is phi star and z derivative of phi. And then it's useful to interpret this z as time. Just for the sake of interpretation, then we can view this phi and phi star as coherent fields for annihilation and creation operator of loop field, loop object. Okay. And then the remaining term can be interpreted as Hamiltonian. So this RG evolution is governed by some Hamiltonian written in this part. And then this partition function can be viewed as a transition amplitude from many-body loop state, from some initial state to the final state under the evolution governed by the Hamiltonian. So this Hamiltonian first has this quadratic term. This quadratic term is basically mass, it's like a mass term for the loop. And the mass is proportional to the length of the loop. So alpha is a constant. Basically, it's a constant that controls the speed of RG. So I can choose certain fixed speed, and then alpha is a constant, and L of C is the length of the loop. So this is a tension. And then the second term is a cubic interaction that describes a splitting process. So if I have a loop, a large loop made of, say, two small loops like C1 and C2, like this. This is C1 and this is C2, connected with each other through some self-retracting links. And then if I integrate out the high energy fields on this link, then this link disappears and it generates two disjoint loops. That's this term. And this F is just some form factor. This is non-zero only when these two loops, C1 and C2, are nearest neighbor, so that they can join together through a nearest neighbor link. And then the final term is a joining term, where if I have two loops like this, C1 and C2, and if they share some link, then if I integrate out high energy field along one link, then these two loops join into one loop. And G is again some form factor, which is non-zero only when C1 and C2 share at least one link. So this is the Hamiltonian in the bulk. And interesting property is that this Hamiltonian is totally independent of the boundary theory. The information on the boundary theory is encoded only through this boundary condition. And then this bulk Hamiltonian is universal.
That action that you wrote on the previous slide,
local in Z.
Yeah.
Is that odd?
Yes, no.
So yeah, in this construction, the locality along the Z direction is manifest. What is not manifest is the locality in the field theory direction, because loop itself is a non-local object, and depending on how large the loop can be, the theory can be non-local. So I will discuss more about the issue of locality.
So what is this V prime? So in what situation should you add this V prime?
V prime.
Yeah.
So you can choose to stop this construction at certain, after finite step. Mm-hmm. Then you have some IR boundary. So you have some UV boundary and then do finite step of RG, and you stop there and you have a IR boundary.
That's determined from your regular Lagrangian.
Right.
V prime is determined from your regular Lagrangian.
Oh, actually this V prime is also universal. It's independent of the original Lagrangian, the action.
So
one can. One can write down this V prime, but it's independent of this J's original theory.
So
the physical picture is the following. So suppose I have this UV boundary. This is Z equals 0, it's here, and then this is this direction. And then in one RG, I can choose to stop here from that one.
Yeah, then you haven't integrated out all your previous field theory degrees freedom.
So there's no original degree of freedom. So everything is the basic degree of freedom is this loop is, but the direction is extended from zero to some finite value. I can do that, or I can choose to.
So remind us how you define it. We had a series of discrete steps.
Right. Right, so I take the dz to zero limit, and then some n times dz to be my z coordinate. So I take the n large and dz small, such that this z changes continuously.
So you're using
N slices of.
You're using the N of the matrices also as
your time step. So this, yeah, sorry, this is the number of this R, this step. So where I stop is my choice. I could have stopped here, and I could have gone forever without having any boundary. But the full partition function should be independent of my choice.
So I'm confused in that you have you always need infinite steps to integrate out completely your previous mode, right? Because each time you only integrate out the segment.
No. So even though I stop here,
yes,
at the last step I can integrate out the U field on this boundary.
Right.
That's what generates this V prime.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, you just say, at some point I can just refer to integrate out everything in one shot.
Right, that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Mm-hmm. And your loop field arose from these dynamical sources that came from integrating out the high energy
right.
fields. So the fact that they end up interacting with just a purely cubic
right.
interaction
right.
is surprising.
Comes from the fact that I'm integrating out high energy mode only infinitesimally. So here the mass of the high energy field is very large in the small dz limit. So all terms that involve more than cubic interaction contains more than one part of dz. So in the small dz limit, I have only those cubic terms. So at each step, I can at most eliminate one link at the order of dz.
If you're doing n 1/dz of that.
That's right, yeah. But at each step, at most I have a cubic interaction.
Yeah, this is just standard in the Poczynski way. You always get cubic.
Right, that's right.
So at least at this stage, there's a very sharp distinction between the z direction and the field theory directions at every point in the ball.
Right, yeah. So it's like having some specific choice of gauge, and I choose some time slices and then work in that gauge.
So if I see itself is only single trace.
Right.
But then you are S
block.
Right. Okay.
So double trace, you can turn on double trace operator here. But they only change the boundary condition. That's all they do in this.
But in principle, in the block, you can in principle also generate an arbitrary number of traces, right?
Right. But so in user RG. Even though you start from single trace operator, you end up generating multi-trace operator. But you can use only single trace field at the expense of making the single trace field dynamical. So I think that's a trade-off you make.
So in the sense of regarding z as time,
making this dynamical. This is not. In the user RG, this coupling constants are fixed at each scale. It's not fluctuating variable. But here is a dynamical field where you have to do the function integration.
You can recover some Lorentz transformations. You decouple. It's a decoupling field. It's like a cover of the Lorentz transformation.
Right.
You decouple something.
Right. That's right. Yeah.
It's just dynamical stuff.
Right. Right. Okay, so another nice feature is that these loop fields are gauge singlet. And as I said, the action is proportional to n squared. Therefore, there must be n squared factor explicitly in front of the action. And one can explicitly see that. Therefore, for in the large limit, the loop fields become classical variable. And then one can find saddle point. And once you find the saddle point in the loop field, then you can consider small fluctuation around the saddle point. And this small fluctuation should describe some propagating a closed string mode in the bulk.
Sorry, your previous slide, this side, so beta is along the z direction?
Right, yeah.
But then what is beta? So what is beta? Beta is just determined by your Lambert-Mills steps.
Right. Yeah.
And psi I is determined by your UV boundary.
Yes.
F is determined by V prime.
Right. That's right. So this is the loop wave function. Basically, psi I is roughly V to the minus V, the UV action. Written in the loop, coherent loop space. I will write the wave function.
I thought your h depends on z, but why only just h multiplied beta? Should we integrate over z? Because h depends on z, right?
H itself does not depend on z. But of course, the solution of the loop field equation will depend on z.
But phi is a function of z. A is a function of z.
It's a dynamical field.
Yes, A depends on z.
Yeah, in general. The solution of the A will depend on z.
A is just a creation operator for loops.
Right.
The only thing that's happening
in
Hamiltonian is just joining and splitting loops.
But there's no translation symmetry in the z direction.
Right. But that follows. I mean, the absence of translation symmetry means that the solution of this loop equation, the saddle point equation, will not have the translational invariance because there is a boundary. But the boundary action in the bulk itself is independent of. It does not explicitly depend on z.
Sorry, somebody asked this, but the loops, can they explore the z direction, or so far they were just loops in the...
Yeah, loops in each slice.
Yeah.
And then, so it's like...
Is that like a gauge torsion?
Yeah, so if I have some worksheet like this, then I choose some slice like this. And this c is defined on each slice. Okay, and then another feature is that this small fluctuation around the saddle point, dynamics of the small fluctuation around the saddle point, is determined by the loop field at the saddle point itself. And this loop field will determine the metric and the background gauge field, etc. But everything is determined dynamically. There's no priorly set the background. So of course, the key question is, when can we trust this saddle point approximation? And when can we ignore some large non-perturbative fluctuations that they describe tunneling from one minimum to another minimum, etc. So to address this question, we first note that this formalism has a large redundancy. And as a result, there is some gauge symmetry. The physical origin of the gauge symmetry is the following. So in the field theory, we have action written as source times operator. But the relative phase between source and operator is ill-defined, right? I can change the phase of the source and then phase of the operator without changing the action. Of course, in usual field theory, the source is fixed. Therefore, this symmetry is explicitly broken. But in this construction, I introduce dynamical source and dynamical VEV at each slice of this RG. Therefore, this source and VEV are dynamical field. Therefore, I can change the phase of the source and then VEV field independently. Without changing the physics. Of course, at the UV boundary, the source is fixed. Therefore, at the UV boundary, this symmetry is broken. But inside the bulk, there's a symmetry because the source and VEVs are dynamical field. So in this sense, this external source can be viewed as some kind of Higgs field that lives on the boundary, that breaks this gauge symmetry explicitly. The consequence of this gauge symmetry.
So should you actually have a much larger symmetry just than a phase? Because if you, in principle, you have the whole field with definition, you can choose your variable arbitrarily in principle.
You mean every unitary conservation?
Not only just that you can have general field with definition, because they are just how you parameterize your fields, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe I don't know. At this stage, this is the manifest symmetry. Yeah. Okay, so the consequence of this gauge symmetry is that there is no quadratic Hopping term for the loop field. So we have in the loop Hamiltonian, we have this tension term. Basically, it's like an on-site term. And there is this cubic joining and splitting term without really changing the shape of the loop field. But there is no term that describes loop hopping from one configuration to another configuration. Such term would violate this gauge symmetry. This is very similar to the situation in the slave particle theory where these partons do not have a hopping term. They can hop only through these mutual hopping processes. Likewise, these loops cannot hop just by themselves. Of course, this does not mean loops are always localized, because if you find some saddle point, and if loop fields have some expectation value at the saddle point, then this cubic term generates quadratic term like this. And then now this small fluctuation around the saddle point acquires this kind of quadratic Hopping term, where this loop can change its shape from one configuration to another configuration. And then the strength of the Hopping is determined by the magnitude of this loop field. And then this loop field is complex field, so it has amplitude and it has also phase. And this phase gives rise to some geometrical phase that this loop acquires when it changes shape. So in this sense, this phase mode of the loop field can be viewed as gauge field that is coupled to this loop field. And this gauge field is now two-form gauge field, not one-form gauge field, because loop is a one-dimensional object. In the slave particle theory, we had one-form gauge field, but here is a two-form gauge field. And another important point is that this two-form gauge field is compact, because it's a phase of a complex field, so 0 and 2 pi is identified. The same way the U1 gauge field in fractionalization is compact U1 gauge field. And then...
Sorry, say again, why this is a two-form?
Two-form means this object is defined not on the link, but on the surface. And then...
Depend on the loop, yeah, just for the loop.
Yeah, yeah, right. And then, just like the slave particle theory, there is no bare kinetic energy term for this two-form gauge field. It's like a bare gauge coupling is infinite. But again, if you integrate out high energy modes, then the dynamics will be generated, and this can be explicitly checked. So in this case, the high energy modes are basically large loops. Because of the tension term, the mass of the loop is proportional to the length. So if I integrate out large loops, then it will generate some derivative term for small loops. And in particular, there are some derivative term for this phase mode. And because of the gauge symmetry, all you can generate is the two-form kinetic energy. And then you can check that the renormalized gauge coupling for the two-form gauge field is proportional to 1 over n squared. This is not surprising because the n squared controls, 1 over n squared controls the quantum fluctuation. So the two-form gauge field also become weakly coupled in the large n limit. And this is some diagrams to show how this kind of term is generated explicitly, but it's not important here. And then, because this two-form gauge field is compact, there is a topological defect. Just like in the U1 gauge theory, because of the compactness, we have monopole. Here, the magnetic charge for the two-form gauge field in D plus 1 dimension is a D minus 3 dimensional object. And I called NS D minus 4 brain. And this is an object around which this two-form gauge field has a magnetic flux by 2 pi. And because the gauge coupling is order of 1 over n squared, the tension of this topological defect is proportional to n squared. Therefore, depending on whether n is large or small, this NS brain may proliferate or not in the space and time. So if n is small, for example, then bare tension of this NS brain is small, then quantum fluctuation may renormalize the tension to a negative value, then this NS brain may condense in space and time. This means that the phase fluctuations of the loop field is very large. Therefore, the loop field cannot provide coherent background on which other loops can propagate coherently. Which means that this string, small fluctuation around this loop configuration is confined, because this string is electrically charged with respect to this two-form gauge field. Therefore, if NS brains are condensed, then strings are confined. Then strings cannot propagate in the bulk, and therefore this bulk description is not useful anymore. On the other hand, if n is sufficiently large, then bare tension is large enough so that these NS brains are suppressed in the long distance limit. Therefore, even though microscopically these NS brains are allowed excitation, they are suppressed in the long distance limit. Therefore, this Bianchi identity emerges dynamically in the long distance limit. In the same sense, the Bianchi identity for U1 gauge field emerges in Coulomb phase. Then we have this deconfined string, then this string now can propagate in the bulk, and then this bulk description now become useful description. And in particular, this two-form gauge field now remains massless in the bulk. So one important point is that the massless U1 gauge field, the massless two-form gauge field is not guaranteed by any symmetry. This is a dynamical feature. This is massless only in this phase where NS brains are suppressed. So if you have a massless field in the bulk, that means you have an operator in your boundary whose scaling dimension is protected from quantum correction. And this protection is not from any microscopic symmetry. And this operator that is dual to this two-form gauge field is the phase mode of the Wilson loop operator. And then in this phase, this phase mode of the Wilson operator will have a scaling dimension which is protected from acquiring large quantum correction, even in the strong coupling limit. And this protection is not obvious from any global symmetry of the boundary theory. So that's the signature that there is something special in the holographic phase for those field theory that have this geometrical interpretation. That's what I call non-trivial quantum order.
I'm a little confused. So the strings are excitations of phi?
Right.
But I thought that the modulus of phi is fixed.
It's
the, because you always consider under the two-form field is the phase of phi.
Right, yeah.
But the modulus of phi is fixed.
It's in general, it's gapped excitation, but it's not completely frozen. It's still dynamical excitation, but it's gapped. So there is a power of excitation.
So that's your so the excitations of the modulus of phi is the strings, are the string excitations?
So it's like a. Any excitation of this phi is a string excitation.
Yeah, so the phi have excitation value.
Right.
And you say the phase of phi is this two form.
Right.
Now what is string? What are the string excitations?
I mean, two form gauge field is also a part of string excitation, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Sure, I'm asking
so here, around the started point, small fluctuations are always string excitation. And then it includes this two-form gauge field.
Yeah, but the two-form gauge field is the only gap is mode here?
That I don't know. Whether there are other, that's whether there is graviton or not. Mm-hmm. That I don't know. But at least two-form gauge field is gapless mode.
But the other excitation is the modulus of the
phi. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there are various size and shapes of the loop. And then phase of those different shapes are independent in general. So it's not just one phase mode. There are many different phase modes. Of course, probably only one of them are gapless.
Now, the geometry is fixed here?
No, geometry is determined by the solution of the loop equation.
Geometry.
Yeah, it's it depends on where you are.
Where does the EDS
emerge? Yeah, so that depends on what theory you are looking at. But I, at this moment, I haven't solved the loop equation explicitly to say that at this set point the geometry is this, at this set point geometry is that.
That's in your mind. What does that mean?
So suppose I find the saddle point, minimize this action, and I will have an equation motion in the loop space. And I will have some background loop field. And this background loop field will determine the strength of the whole thing. And then strength of the whole thing include information about the distance in the space, because the larger the whole thing, easier for this loop field to change its shape. And that is equivalent to saying that the distance from, say, loop C prime and C plus C prime is small. And this is a dynamical variable because this loop field itself is dynamical. In this sense, metric is a dynamical variable. But at this moment, I don't know whether this metric degrees freedom should be gapless or not.
In A, it's 5 times as 5. This beam in new field is due to some particular F cubed operator
right.
Dimensions. So then now, whenever I see Young Mill series, somebody can test on the lattice whether this particular F cubed operator has dimension 6. You would be telling me that.
So, in that, in the N equal force for Young Mills, there's a transignment term. So, if you have just gapless 2-form cage field, then you would expect a scaling dimension 2. But
yeah,
in the
N equal it disappears because it would be F mu itself, and that isn't.
And there's a transignment term between this two-form gauge field and the long field, and that makes the scaling dimension to 6.
But the fact that it's this F cubed guy, you would say that's special, but you don't know what operator in the field is.
It's an F cubed here, too. It's a phase mode of the Wilson loop operator.
That's also F cubed.
Right.
But why is the phase mode? How do those words? Why do I know that the phase mode of the Wilson loop is the F cubed?
So, okay, so I have a Wilson loop operator, and then phase mode, suppose the expectation value of Wilson loop is mirror, then the phase mode is equivalent to the imaginary part of
reasonable.
But and this contains strips of f, but for SUM this is zero. The first non-zero contribution is f2. F square is real part. F2 is,
so if somebody can simulate the Young-Mills theory on the lattice, would be saying that's what they should be looking for.
Right.
Enormous dimension of trace.
That's right.
And if that is vanishing, then you should have a holographic point.
Right.
Yeah. Well, it's necessary. It might not be useful.
Right. Yeah.
But that's the analog of the two massless modes in the toy model.
That's right. That's right.
Base FQ test by some accidental reason, assuming the accidental reason has scaling dimension
six. Without any fine tuning.
Information for this is in topological phase that has
scaling.
In the NS brain, is there some interesting geometry there?
Sorry?
I mean, you talked about when the NS brain was condensed, but at the transition point?
Yeah, so I will talk more about what happens if NS strings are condensed. What happens to the bulk geometry?
Well, I meant at the transition point, whether
at the transition between what?
The massive and the condensed phase.
Okay, yeah, so I will discuss more. Yeah.
I'm actually still confused about your point. You say, so I can have many, many different loops, right?
Right.
So, well, you say all the loops, all the phase of all Wilson loops is controlled by a single phase, or you're talking about there's an overall phase of all those loops?
So I think there is only one gapless phase mode, but there are many gapped phase modes. For example,
so you say there's overall phase?
Right.
Some kind of.
So I have a. In the action, I have this kind of term where, say, these two plug heads join into this large plug head. So I have, let's call it this C1 and C2, and this C1 plus C2. So in the action, I have C1 plus C2 star, phi C1, phi C2. So this kind of term, so it, as a dynamical field, all these fields are independent fields. And phase mode of this field, phase mode of this field are independent of each other. But because of this term, they lock the phase between these two, between these three. For example, I have, from this term, I have some cosine term, bc1 plus c2 minus bc1 and bc2, for example. This kind of generate mass for the outer phase mode. And then only gapless mode is the mode where change here is cancelled by change here. That's the gapless two-form gauge.
That's the overall phase,
right.
All loops.
Right.
But also, actually, phi c, they are highly redundant, right? It's not actually independent of each other. But they
are. As a dynamical field, there is no other constraint.
You said they are independent.
For any infinity.
Yeah.
Okay.
Even for finite n, as a dynamical field, they are independent. But
in your loops aren't so simple. The loops that
mm-hmm. So I think that is encoded through the interaction. So one loop and another loop can, for example, this loop and the same loop can go into, say, this loop.
Right, so therefore the phis have any number of windings, and they're not all independent.
Right, so that's through this kind of interaction.
Interaction,
but as a right
wall.
But as a kinematical, at the kinematical level, they are independent fields. Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, for finite, then, because W to the N, think about it, has NI of values?
Right. Yeah. So, but this phi is not. It's not directly the Wilson loop itself. It's some vacuum expectation value of this thing. The same as the.
You're discussing what's called, I guess,
is not the gauge thing, right? I mean, your vertices are just compact features.
Right, yeah.
They're still on that.
Yeah, yeah, I understand that this object is not for any power of this thing.
For example, yeah.
It's not fully independent for arbitrary large n. That, that therefore it is, it makes sense that all these fields are not independent. But from this construction, they seem to be all independent. And but the relation is through this kind of interaction. One loop and another loop can join to multiply winding loops, but they are dynamically connected. So probably
you do the, when you write the measure there, the measure has to take that.
So this measure,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, this measure is just so simple. You consider all possible loops.
But I think that the phi c won't know, this kind of local interaction won't know that the winding n times, n plus one times is the same as winding one time. That won't know this, right? This local interaction. N plus one will be the same as n, as one. But this trace relation will tell you n plus one is actually equal to one.
Isn't the point that phi's were essentially introduced by hand as auxiliary fields?
Yeah.
Introduced extra fields.
So in this sense, there are some redundancy, extra redundancy.
Does Kurt do that? They're auxiliary fields. He says extra ones, and then
the relations come out the other. You have to start out with something, starting out with everything. Starting out with, even when you start out, you can't start.
So you can pretend that they are independent, but the way that they are not really independent is implemented through some dynamics. It's like...
I suggest that tells you one.
Okay, yeah.
Go back to his point at the end.
But at the level of mathematical construction, they are just independent. So probably they suggest that they are still very redundant. Okay, so now let's discuss about possible phases of the boundary matrix model using the holographic description. And to discuss that, we first note that there are two important parameters here. One of n squared is the parameter that controls the interaction between the loops, or the n squared is the tension of the nth plane. And then these j's are inverse of the tooth coupling, but here there isn't just one J, but there are a set of J's that is defined on each loop. So this roughly controls the size of a loop, because the larger the J, the larger the loop amplitude, and the larger the loop amplitude, the hopping strength of the string increases. So that means for large J, loop can change its configuration from one shape to another shape, which are quite different from each other. Therefore, the larger the J, the wall sheet of this string become larger and larger in the target space. And as I said, in the UV boundary, there is an external source term that explicitly breaks this gauge symmetry. Therefore, the phase mode of the loop field is gapped near the UV boundary. Therefore, the NS brains are always suppressed at the UV boundary. But anything can happen in the IR bulk.
What do you mean always? I mean, can't I just turn off those external sources and then not have the suppression?
Okay, so provided that I turn on some non-trivial source term at the UV boundary.
But I'm free to turn them off.
Yes, yeah, right. That's right.
And I'm probably free to turn on some kind of magnetic dual source that would promote these new emotional planes.
I haven't thought about it. Yeah. Okay, so suppose the J's, the source at the UV boundary is very small, then loop equation says that as you go to IR, the amplitude of the loop field becomes smaller and smaller. This is like a strong coupling limit of your gauge theory. If you start from very strong coupling, then the gauge coupling become larger and larger as you go to infrared. That means loop amplitude becomes smaller and smaller. That means in the deep infrared, the loop amplitude is so small that the phase fluctuations of the loop field has no phase thickness. That means loop fields are strongly disordered. That corresponds to the situation where NS grains are condensed in the quark. So because of large phase fluctuations of the loop field, the strings that carries the electric charge for the two-form gauge field is confined. So if you measure, say, Wilson-Knuth correlation function, then you insert these strings at the boundary and they propagate in the bulk, but they cannot propagate into the bulk, into the IR region, because here the strings are confined. So they stay within the UV region. Moreover, if this loop field is very small, then the kinetic term for the loop field is very small. So essentially, these strings are in the insulating phase. So if you insert a particle, then the world line of this particle, the string is a straight. And this is the case where the Wilson-Knuth correlation function decays exponentially. So this is the picture for the gap phase of the matrix model. Suppose we make this J very large at the UV boundary. Then suppose for the sake of argument, suppose the dimension of space-time is large, like 5 dimension. And then that means initially we have very weak coupling. Then in 5 dimension, gauge coupling is irrelevant. So then as we go to IR, the gauge coupling becomes weaker and weaker. In the loop language, this loop field becomes larger and larger in the infrared limit. That means, of course, the NS grains are now suppressed because the loop amplitude is so large, so that there's large phase thickness. But if you insert some small string at your boundary, then this quickly becomes very non-local because loop amplitude is large and it can mediate hopping from one configuration to another very different configuration. So here, the locality is not present in the bulk description. Although formally you say there is a bulk space, but the dimensionality is not that meaningful because your excitations are very non-local in the bulk. Now suppose I tune the parameter J to a critical point between this confinement phase to this IR-free deconfinement phase. Of course, there is no guarantee that these transitions are second order, but suppose I tune many parameters on J, and then I look at the second order phase transition, then at least there are two possibilities for the critical phases to be realized. First scenario is what I call non-holographic critical state. So this is likely to happen for small n. So since n is small, the tension of the NS grain is small, still small. Therefore, this NS grains remain condensed in the bulk. But the loop amplitude is large enough within the UV region so that if you insert this string at the boundary, they cannot propagate into bulk, but they are in the metallic phase within the d-dimensional space. The worship of this string is delocalized along the d-dimensional direction, not along this extra dimension. And still, the correlation function can decay in a power law. This is at least a logical possibility. And then, this is a critical state, but here in this kind of phase, the bulk description, there's no geometrical description for this critical phase. That's what I call non-holographic critical phase. On the other hand, if n is large, now NS grains are condensed. NS grains are suppressed in the bulk. So if I insert a string, then they can explore the bulk. Yeah, they can explore the bulk space. And then the correlation function of this Wilson-Knuth operator is determined by the geometry of the bulk. And then, as I said, the gapless mode in the bulk means that there is an operator whose scaling dimension is protected even at strong coupling limit. So here is a phase diagram. So I consider a dimension, space-time dimension greater than 4, because for pure gauge theory, bosonic gauge theory, and in dimension 4 or less than 4 is always in the gap space. So that's why I consider large dimension. But if you add fermions or some fundamental matters, then you may stabilize critical phase in lower dimension. But here, for simplicity, let us consider the pure adjoint matrix model in this dimension. Then in the strong coupling limit, when the toothed coupling is very large, then no matter what the n is, the theory is in the gap phase, so it's a confined phase. But if the bare coupling is weak, small, then, as I said, in the infrared, it flows to free fixed point, because the gauge coupling in dimension greater than 4 is irrelevant. Now, you can consider some phase transition, and suppose I tune one or more than one parameters to make the phase transition second order, then there are at least two different kinds of second order phase transition. If n is small, then this ns grain that is condensed in the confinement phase can remain condensed even at the critical point. And then the critical correlation is mediated by this d-dimensional fluctuation of the string. Whereas if n is large, then the topological defects are suppressed at the critical point. Then there is a geometrical description, and this is what I call holography critical points. So this is very similar to what people studied in condensable community, the deconfined quantum criticality, where at the critical point, some topological defects are dynamically suppressed so that you have emergent gauge field with some fractionalized excitation. But that's not guaranteed. The n here must be larger than certain critical number in order for that to happen. So what I'm saying is that this holographic critical point is not automatic. It requires n to be sufficiently large. Otherwise, you will get different kinds of critical points.
So do you know whether this is really a critical point or phase? Like in your previous,
whether there is a phase here.
Because here, in principle, can be a phase, right? Like in your slave boson model.
Right. In principle, I think it is possible, but I don't know.
So you don't have any indication whether this would be a point or if it's a phase.
Right. Yeah. I don't know whether.
So this is like a weak duality. Did you say that the gauge coupling lambda has to be small in order to have a deconfined phase with the macroscopic bulk? So in this case, you would be able to do gravity calculations for some effort.
No, not necessarily. This, at the critical point, the lambda can be still.
No, but way beyond that. Let's
here,
get
here.
Farther out there.
Oh, this is this is a free theory in the boundary. Yeah. And in the bulk, you have the non-local description.
Not local, but it's confined. Okay, so there's some geometry there, but it's just some non-local.
Right. Yeah. But on this critical point, we have some local description. Okay. So the summary is that general d-dimensional quantum field theory can be formulated in one higher dimension where the basic degree freedoms are dynamical source and VEV, and in the matrix model, the bulk theory become field theory of closed loops, and then when n is sufficiently large, then the topological defect is suppressed, and then we have emergent space and the confined string and operator with the protected scaling dimension. Although I haven't discussed here, there's another interesting possibility where this closed string can further get fractionalized into open string. And if you have open ends, then there's an emergent U1 one-form gate. So emergent one-form gauge field in the similar way that the fractionalization occurs. But this is very speculative at the moment. Thank you for your attention.
So in this fractionization open string discussion, is there a mechanism for making things like deep rings?
Yeah, I think if you have open string, then you can use some deep grain
matrix. What I mean is there some mechanism that makes it natural? Is it interesting that what it would mean to have open strings attached only to certain submanifolds of the spacetime as opposed to space-filling open strings?
Yeah,
Can you use fractionalization locally, or do you actually come out of the entire node?
So here, I think if you just have open string, then you have space-time filling.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So is there an actual mechanism to get a localized deep brain?
I don't know. I mean, if if you have some compact space, and if the size of the compact space is way smaller, for example, then you better use the particular description, then that way you may have some localized difference. But that's the only interaction. But without that, I don't know how to get just different with our way.
You could presume in the matrix model at fundamental degrees of freedom only on some sides and not on the others.
Then from the beginning you have some.
From the beginning you have
some degree only on the limits.
You give the example of a kind of linear sigma version of a gauge theory as an example of this kind of theory.
Right.
And that's like it might flow to the gauge theory. But it also have phase varying and you might land in there. But that's not this. That's not what you're calling for.
I think that's why I'm not.
You're saying this is just the gauge theory.
This is for that matrix.
But that was very general. I mean, it's very general. It has an infinite number of companies on that. So this is some slice of a very large phase.
Right. So this represents a large set of companies.
For gauge theories, I mean, there is, coupled to appropriate matter, there are conformal. I mean, there's the Banks' access points. Could they be somehow in this class of your fixed points?
There are some fundamental matters.
But that fundamental, you have gauge fields plus the extra radial degrees of freedom. So you have, in some sense, degrees of freedom play the same role as that exact fermion. So can I think in any way of that phase being at all related to what you're doing?
But still here, everything is
unobserved. Right. So you say, we don't know for sure. It's possible those degree all do that, but we just don't know.
What happens if you try to do the same thing for gauge theory? Are you not very interested?
Yeah, that I tried, but the formalism is more difficult because of the constraint of the matrix. So linear version of the theory is much easier because you don't have constraints for the matrix. But still, this model is generally not to include the user gauge theory.
This Deakin Fine phase, I think I understood it as a type of kind of Coulomb phase.
Yeah, so.
Isn't there also a Higgs phase? Possibly it could be in a Higgs. That sort of Higgs phase? I mean, that's still.
So this is just a free Coulomb phase. Three Coulomb phase. In this.
So more critical dimension. About four dimensions.
Higgs.
Yeah, there's no Higgs.
So here you have Coulomb, Cantor's Coulomb.
Yeah.
And from the string solving point of view, this is the string condensed phase.
Right. Yes. So here strings of all sides are condensed.
I think that sounds like